Friday morning, Lauren and I were driving back home from the coast, and I started out with sinus pressure. And as we were crossing over the mountains and we began to see those little yellow plants on the side of the road, which I think suspiciously look like ragweed in Texas, that headache became blinding and painful, and I uttered words that a man almost never utters. Babe, I may have to pull over and let you drive. But I persevered, much to her disappointment. But I had been planning, after looking over the men's material and seeing that we were looking at Samson and the lesson on great men are grateful, I had suspected that that class might create some questions about why is Samson mentioned in Hebrews 11 as one of the faithful people, a witness to us. And in case you don't know what I'm talking about, let me put it up on the screen for you. There it goes. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 30 says, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she welcomed the spies in peace. And what more shall I say? So the Hebrew writer at this point has made the case for faith that he was going to make. But just to show that that is not an exhaustive list of what of those that are going to prove his point, we're going to talk about what that point is in just a few minutes. And what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness, were made strong, became mighty, put foreign armies to flight, women received back their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting their release, so that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings. Yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with the sword. And they went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy. I have a whole lesson on that statement because I think it's just a beautiful statement. Those nameless people, that the world is not worthy of those who were willing to suffer because they trust God, because they believe that God is faithful. The world's not worthy of seeing that kind of faith, but it is that kind of faith that is the great testimony for us. Wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground, and all of these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had promised something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. When we're talking about those that I had highlighted on the screen, did you notice anything that they had in common? Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah. They're all from what book of the Bible? The Judges. Judges, just audience participation, high point in the faith of Israel and the nation, or low point? Low point. In fact, probably, arguably, the lowest point, right? The book of Judges closes not with great acts of the judges, but rather the terrible acts of people, of men, who, because there was no king in Israel, every man did what was right in his own eyes. And so that's something to take into thought, maybe, as we're considering Gideon, the judge who wanted God to prove himself. And his commemorative ephod became an idol to his house and people. It's something to take into account when we're thinking of Barak or Barak. Now, he was not a judge, but he was a general. What's he known for? He was the general who wouldn't go to war unless Deborah went with him. How about Jephthah? He was the judge who tried to buy God's faithfulness. He didn't believe God was faithful, so he promised to offer God a sacrifice. The first thing that comes out to me after I win this battle, I'm going to offer it to you. That's not a sacrifice of faith. That's a sacrifice of trying to buy God's favor, and we see how futile that is based on the story of Jephthah's daughter. And then, of course, the elephant on the room, there's Samson. What do we know about Samson? Well, this story spans three chapters of the book of Judges, from 13 to 16. And in those chapters, we're not going to read those tonight. I think you're familiar with the stories, but I'll summarize it. In those chapters, what do we know about Samson? We know that he was born under the Nazarite vow. There are three basic tenets to the Nazarite vow: that you couldn't cut your hair, you couldn't drink wine, you weren't even supposed to be around grapes, and then you weren't to have any interaction with dead bodies. He's a Nazarite, okay? So he is consecrated for God. That's the idea of the Nazarite vow. But we see that Samson is killing a lion with his bare hands. That doesn't sound very Nazarite of him. He's eating honey from a dead lion. The lion didn't make the honey, the bees did. But not only did he do that, but he gave it to his parents to eat. He married a foreign wife. That's something that gave his parents great consternation. It troubled their spirit that he did that. And not only did he marry a foreign wife, he took vengeance on those who cheated him by burning their fields. This is not sounding very Nazarite-ish. He killed 1,000 men with the jawbone of a donkey. He carried the city gates when people were lying in wait for him. Remember, he pulled off the gates and carried them. He was tempted and betrayed by Delilah, a woman who does not seem to be his wife according to the text, but it seems obvious that he was in a sexual relationship with her. He was blinded. He cried out to God, and he destroyed the Philistine temple, killing thousands. In fact, it was said of Samson that he killed more people in his death than he killed in his life. If you were describing a faithful person, a man of God, is that the picture you draw? A vengeful, angry, vow-breaking, sexually immoral person. Is that the picture you're drawing of a faithful person? Probably not. And for years, I've heard people speculate on this. I've seen the explanations why is Samson mentioned in Hebrews 11. Well, some people speculate that because he is a judge, that would have indicated that he knew the law. That was the purpose of judges. It wasn't just to go to war. Judges were supposed to be people that settled dispute because they knew the law of Moses. Who, remember, it was under Moses that judges were first set up. So there's a possibility. Maybe we're just seeing Samson on his lowest days. I mean, I don't want anybody to take a look at my low light reel and judge my faith. I'm sure you all feel the same. Second possibility is he could be the high watermark, and this is really saying something. This guy could be the high watermark of faith during a point of really low faith. Well, that says more about the nation of Israel than it does Samson. Possibility. It has been suggested that maybe Samson's life looked a lot more like what we see in Judges 13 through 16, but that his turn to God at the end is indicative of a true repentance. Perhaps. We know the Spirit of the Lord returns to him. You know, that's one of the things, that the image I use, Samson looks like this mighty, strong man with all these muscles, but every time that Samson does something really amazing, it says the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. So Samson may have looked more like me, but it was the Spirit of the Lord that was doing those things. We don't know. He is a tool for God's judgment. How did God use Samson? Did he use him to destroy the enemies of his people? Yeah, the Philistines really don't resurge again until a little bit later. He wiped out a pretty good number of them, and it's not until the end of Eli that the Philistines, in his judgment, that the Philistines are a problem again. But what if it's something else? And what if that something else means that maybe, just maybe, we've been reading Hebrews 11 the wrong way? You see, I think, because it was taught to me this way, that Hebrews 11 is this book about people who had amazing faith. Like, we should strive to have faith like Abel and Enoch, and we should strive to have faith like Noah. Remember, he saved his whole family. He moved with godly fear. Or Abraham, or Isaac, or Jacob. And even Jacob gives me a little bit of pause, because there's not much good said about Jacob. Even at the end of his life, he's swindling his kids out of part of an inheritance, so Joseph, who he likes better, still likes better, can get a little more. But maybe this book, incidentally, a book that has been all about what God has accomplished through Jesus, that he's been hinting at since the Old Testament. Maybe this chapter is not meant to tell us that we should have a faith like Moses, but what it is meant to help us see is the God who provokes that kind of faith in the hearts of people that are searching for him. Let me highlight some things for you as we read this chapter. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the convictions of things not seen. I want you to hold that verse in your mind, because that's not just a definition of faith. It's telling you how faith works. Remember how I told you this morning about that bumper sticker that I've liked for years and years? Faith is seeing the end of a thing from before the beginning. The Hebrew writer said that, not the guy that wrote the bumper sticker. It's the evidence, the assurance of things that we're hoping for, and it's the convictions of things not seen. For by it, the men of old gained approval. By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things which are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. Why don't you stop and think about what that just said about Abel? Abel's got faith, right? He's offering a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. But was that really the point of what was being said there? Or is the point, God is telling you that that is commendable faith? God is testifying about that. And though he is dead, because God still speaks about that kind of faith, he still lives. You see, we miss that, don't we? Because we sort of put Abel up on this pedestal, and we're not thinking about what it's teaching us about God. Not that Abel doesn't have a commendable faith. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death, and he was not found because God took him up, for he obtained the witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. And then you have this statement. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. I like the way the King James amplifies that, diligently seek him. But I want you to consider what we just learned from Abel and Enoch, and the lesson that we're going to learn from Noah. We're going to switch gears when we get over to Abraham, but Noah's moved with godly fear. What's the lesson there? That these guys have super big faith? No. I mean, Abel's is not a faith that I would call super big. He's offering sacrifices that God told him to. The lesson there isn't about really Abel, it's about God. It's about what we learn about God through Abel, and through Enoch, and through Noah. That God not only exists, but that he rewards those that are seeking him, or diligently seeking him. Not only that, continuing on from there, by faith, Noah, being warned by God
about things not yet seen in reverence, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Now, I got to admit, that how long did it take Noah to put the ark together? 100 years. Peter says that time, what's he doing during that time? He's a what? He's a preacher of righteousness. You know, we were talking about Jonah a few weeks ago. Maybe one of the most effective preachers of all time. In fact, I was listening to Daniel in his meeting that he preached this afternoon. In one of his lessons, he mentioned Jonah, about 120,000 people in the city of Nineveh. Most effective preacher of all time. Noah, kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum. That guy preached for 100 years and didn't convert anybody. Noah's got pretty big faith. He's building an ark, right? But why is he doing that? Because God's reward to Noah was that he warned him. You ever think about that? By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen in reverence, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Funny word that shows up in Genesis chapter 6 when you're discussing Noah, and I've used this illustration before, that Noah found favor in the eyes of God. That's the Hebrew word for grace. Noah found grace. Noah found a gift from God. God didn't have to save Noah. God didn't need to save Noah. God wanted to do that. Noah is not teaching us about, hey, look at this guy that was super obedient and all these things. He used the right wood and the right dimensions and the right pitch and all of those things. Yes, that's important. But that's not the first lesson. The first lesson in the story of Noah is that God gave him grace because Noah found favor with God. Because he was a righteous man. If we miss the lesson about God, then the story of Noah doesn't make sense. I should just go build a boat because God's happy with that. Well, it wasn't a boat, it didn't have a keel. I should go build a big box that's boat-shaped, that's bigger than our building and parking lot, that because God's really, really pleased with that. No. That's not the lesson of Noah. The lesson of Noah is that Noah was warned that's God's gift. And because he feared God, had reverence for God, he moved in that way because that's what God's looking for. Moving on from there, it says, by faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. That's pretty big faith. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise, for he was looking for a city which has foundation, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who was promised. Therefore, there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead, at that, as many descendants as the stars of the heaven in numbers, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. All these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them, and having them welcomed from a distance. Bart was talking about that this morning in Bible class. They're welcoming the promises of God from a distance. And that Moses doesn't fully understand how God's Abraham doesn't fully understand how God's going to resolve that sacrifice on Moriah. But he knows he's going to do it because God's got a promise that ends in his family being a blessing to the whole world, right? So he's welcoming that promise, though it's far away. And having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, for those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of the country from which they went out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. And here's the God statement. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You see, the purpose of those statements is not, hey, look at Abraham's faith. God wants us to go wonder. Look at Abraham's faith. Look at Sarah's faith. Everybody needs to start conceiving in their 80s. It's that God is faithful to that kind of faith. That's the lesson. God had prepared a place for people like Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob that wasn't of this world. It's of the next world. It wasn't going to be in the land of Canaan. Their descendants would inherit that, sure. But he was preparing something that was a heavenly country. That their wandering was not about, what's God going to give me today? It was about trusting that God had made a promise. And do you see what that says about God? He went through great lengths to make these promises. These promises, Abraham and Sarah are just the beginnings of that promise. It's like the spark that lights the fire. But it's going to turn into the glory revealed of Jesus coming in the flesh. That's how God fulfilled that promise. The lesson there is not God rewarded Abraham because he wandered in a tent. Or he wandered and slept in a tent. The lesson there is that God seeks people who are seeking Him. And He's made provision for them. Then, you come down to the sprint to the end of the chapter. By faith, Abraham, verse 17, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, who had received the promise. He who had received the promise was offering up his only begotten son, and it was he to whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendants shall be called." He considered, we talked about this morning, that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding those things to come. By faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. Commendable faith? Sure. Every one of those people is saying in the things they're doing, God fulfills his promises. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure the ill treatment of the people of God than enjoy the passing pleasure of sin, considering, this is an interesting statement about Moses, the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasure of Egypt. Did Moses really understand what Jesus was going to go through? No, but in a way he endured it. That's why Moses was a type of him who was to come. For he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. By faith he passed through they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through the dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell, and after that they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies. Then you come to verse 32. And what more shall I say, for time will fail me, if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel. And we've already read this part, and we know what it's coming to. That what we're seeing in all of these, from Moses forward, is that God is trying to give something better to us. So what's really under consideration? Well, just like the rest of the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 11 is proof that what God is doing through Christ is better than anything he's ever done before. The heavenly country, the city with foundation that Jesus offers, is better than the one that Abraham was sojourning through. That the salvation that Jesus offers is better than the one that Noah found. That the sacrifice of Jesus is better than the sacrifice of Abel. that the one who led Israel out of Egypt in the Exodus is not greater than the one who has led us from in Exodus from sin and death.
And if we lose focus on the fact that Hebrews is about Jesus being superior to everything that came before, then we do start wondering, why do guys like Samson show up in here? But let me offer this for your consideration. What we've learned from looking at the book of Hebrews this way, chapter 11, is that there's never a time, even during the lowest point of Israel's faith, the judges, when God is not faithful. Paul alludes to that in 2 Timothy chapter 2 when he talks about the need to confess Christ and how Jesus, we may deny him, but he cannot deny himself. God is always faithful to his promises. But not only that, even at that low water mark, God is faithful first. God didn't reward Noah after he built the ark. God warned Noah before he built the ark. Did you ever notice that? God didn't offer Abraham this great promise because Abraham decided, hey, today feels like a day I'm going to uproot my life. Sarai, because his name was Abram then, right? Sarai, I want you to gather up all the livestock and all the servants, and we're going to go live in a tent. I don't know why. It just feels like a good thing to do. And God says, hey, I respect that. I like that. That's not how God called him. God told him to go. You see, God is faithful first. But not only is God faithful first, the end of that message proves that God is faithful in the end. These all died in faith, and they were not made perfect apart from us because God had something better in store for us. That God has the full revelation of Jesus in store for us. That's what we're recipients of. And that's evidence to us that God is faithful before we are. The message of Jesus and Him crucified was written long before I was born onto this earth. You know what that tells me? My God was faithful to me long before I was faithful to Him. And so with that frame of reference, we begin to understand that God provides a glorious hope for the faithful. Remember what they were looking for? A city with foundation, whose builder and maker was God. They were looking for that heavenly country, that heavenly city. Why were they looking for that? Because God had promised it. And God is faithful specifically to His promises. That's why Moses, esteeming the sufferings of Christ better than all the riches of Egypt and looking forward to the promise, is so important. Again, God made the promise first. God is faithful to deliver His people. I think that's what's under consideration when you get to Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah. These aren't perfect men with extraordinary faith. In fact, we see them highlighted at their weakest moments. But God used them to deliver His people so He could keep on bringing about that promise. And when we forget about this and we make Hebrews 11 about the people rather than the lessons of faith that can be learned through them, then we miss this. Because these witnesses are not people of amazing faith. They are those who have faith in an amazing God. And their faith looked forward to Jesus. Did Samson know he was looking forward to Jesus when he stood between the two pillars and said, let me die with the Philistines? No. But did he know that God was faithful? Because He had promised something to His people. Yes. How do I know that? Because that's what the Hebrew writer is telling us. Samson is not somebody that we want our kids to go and emulate. Even if all we have is pictures of him on his worst days and every other day, he was the best servant of God ever. And I would not argue that that's not a possibility. But that's not the point. The point is, Samson knew something about God.
And if you know that same thing about God, that He delivers, that He is always faithful, that He is faithful first, that He has given you a glorious hope, that He never goes back on His promises, then you know those lessons. Then in you will grow a faith that is bigger than what you see in Gideon and Barak and Jephthah and Samson. How do I know that? Because of what the Hebrew writer says in the 12th chapter. Therefore, since we have a great cloud of witnesses, what have they been testifying to? What we have up on the screen, right? Here's what our faith needs to look like. Because I see God was faithful to Samson, even though Samson didn't deserve it. Because I see God was faithful to Noah, even though Noah wasn't perfect, he's regarded as righteous, but God gives him grace and warns him before we didn't have to. What's the lesson? Let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And if I had 45 minutes, I'd break down Hebrews 12 for you, because I think it's a wonderful way to end Hebrews 11, but we're not going to do that tonight. I'll save that for another night. What's the lesson about Samson? Samson could bring down the temple of the Philistines because he knew who his God was. He knew God was faithful. And he died believing that God would make good on the promise and use him as a deliverer. That's why he's in the book of Hebrews. Not because his faith is perfect or even may not even be worthy of imitating, except for that. But he's proof that God delivers. And he's a testimony of the great things that God fully accomplished in Jesus. Does your faith look forward? Can you see the end before you've even begun? Do you have faith that looks to Jesus, who could look forward through the cross, despising its shame, saying, I'll go through that to get to you? And who's now seated at the right hand of God? Do you have that kind of faith? You have reason to, because God hasn't changed. And that testimony is still true. Lay aside the weight. Come out of the snares and run with endurance. Are you doing it tonight? You owe some duty to God if you've never been baptized for the forgiveness of sins. Or you have and you've wandered away. Come forward confessing as we stand and sing.